And welcome to the Department of Metal Antiquities.
Where we remember what everyone else has forgotten.
As always, it is Nick Cameron, also of the Glacial Musical Podcast. I am joined by my good friend, a man about town, a man who's always there, a musical, munching, maleficent something who I'm still cursing for getting me into the Mighty Boosh, Duncan Evans. How are we doing today?
Hello, Nick. Yes, I'm doing pretty well today. Been for a long walk. I've got my cup of mint tea. Things are all right. How about yourself?
Spectacular. I am a little angry with you right now because of you, and just because of you, Apple TV is going to get me for another $50. I was planning on canceling my subscription to Apple TV this week or next week or whenever, but before the end of this current billing cycle. And then I discovered that Noel Fielding has a new show on Apple Television. Are you aware of this?
I am not aware of this, no. I think you sent me the link, which I didn't have a chance to look at.
That was a mistake. That I didn't mean to send that, but yes. It is The Completely Made-Up Adventures of Dick Turpin. And it stars
I've heard of it.
Noel Fielding, and his brother has a role in it. And Rich Fulker, who is the American from The Mighty Boosh, has had one cameo in it. I believe he comes in a bit more. And the guy that played the amazing actor with the big birthmark, he was in the first episode. So, of course, you know, you've got The Mighty Boosh guys showing up on this show. And it's this absolutely hysterical show. And it just started. They've only put out 4 episodes, and I'm going to be in probably for another 5 months of Apple TV because of this stupid show. Also, if anybody can, watch it. It's amazing.
Cool. Well, sorry about that, Nick.
It's all right. We'll make it. We'll make it right somehow.
Anyway, we will. Yes.
Nobody is here to hear about my television show reviews. We are here to talk about Chelsea. Are we talking about the British punk rock band? No. Are we talking about the American punk rock band Chelsea? Also no. We are talking about Chelsea from New York City, who is listed as pop rock, featuring Peter Criss of Kiss fame on the drums. No vocals, though.
Yeah, before he joined Kiss. So this was the debut self-titled record from 1970 called Chelsea. So I believe Peter Criss joined Kiss in 1973.
Yeah, like around June 1973. And at that point in time, when he joined Kiss, he was 9 years older than Paul Stanley. So he was pushing 30 when he joined Kiss. And it's interesting to think about how Kiss had this amazing anonymity that could never be done again today. In fact, we have learned that it cannot be done with Ghost because the identities of Ghost were quickly discovered in this modern era. But these guys, and he was credited on this album as Peter Criss, but only with one S.
True, yes.
But this is 1970. And his face was out there, and it wasn't like they were on some fly-by-night record label. They were on Decca Records. I don't think we have done a Decca Records release so far on this show.
Maybe not. No, maybe not.
So
I think it says MCA for this album, strangely enough, but perhaps they were linked anyway.
Probably at this point in time, Decca was owned by MCA because Decca is a very prestigious elder label. It was a blues label primarily. I want to say even the Beatles were on Decca for a minute.
I've got a feeling they might have been. I was thinking that.
So either way, they're on a prestigious label. They're on a really, really cool label. But so you have this band Kiss that had all of this amazing ability to be completely anonymous for so long, where one of the four members, Peter, had released an album under his Kiss stage name. And then Ace had a band called Malimo that I believe there were some photos about of that band floating around. And again, his stage name was just his nickname and his last name, Ace Frehley. So probably wouldn't have been all that hard to find that as well. And then Gene and Paul, their pictures were on the Wicked Lester album, which is probably something we should also do on this show.
Probably should, yeah.
It was never released commercially. The record label decided not to release it. And then when Kiss got popular, they decided to make Kiss purchase the record from them. And then Kiss, who now owns it and has owned it for nearly 50 years, has chosen to not release it, not release anything from it, and leave it completely buried. However, of course, there are versions that have survived.
Indeed.
I think the band Chelsea is probably most notable for the fact that this is where the song that saved Kiss is originally written and recorded. That song, of course, being People's Choice Award-winning Beth. Peter Criss loves to talk about how that he won a People's Choice Award with that song.
Okay, but that's not on this album.
No, it is not on this album. It was written and recorded for their next unreleased album, because that album.
Okay, right. I did not know that.
So they wrote, recorded a second album, and it was scrapped by the label, at which point the band broke up, and Peter Criss and Stan Penridge, who become lifelong off and on again off and on partners, and then one other member of the band, Michael
Michael Benvega. Benvenga, yeah.
Benvenga. I'm gonna guess that's an Italian name. I don't know for sure. So they started Lips, and then Lips ended up becoming just Peter and Stan Penridge, and then. Even during the Kiss years, Stan Penridge was still writing with Peter Criss, and they even had a very short-lived band in the early 80s after the two Peter Criss solo records flopped, as there was no tour, called the Criss Penridge Alliance, because apparently that was a name that completely made sense to them.
Indeed,
Oh,
indeed.
sorry, we're both trying to take a drink at the same time.
All
So,
right, well, I've had mine.
1970, let's actually start there. 1970, the band that becomes Kiss is not even a thought in anybody's head. I believe Peter, or not Peter, I believe Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons are working together at this point, and they will soon form Wicked Lester. However, we're not there yet. 1970 is a transitional year in the ter in terms of music. One of the things that I have said many, many times, and will probably say a thousand more times before I die on this show alone, is that when we talk about decades of music, January 1st, 1970 is not part of the 70s, in my opinion. January 1st, 1970 is still part of 1969, because it take, especially in this time frame, it takes time for the trends and the wheels to start moving over. And
Yeah, I think there are some bands or artists or trends which are ahead of their time and some which are a bit behind the time. So you can probably see a lot of the trends and tropes and things which the 70s is known for starting to come around in the late 60s. For example, Led Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, they're there right at the very end of the 60s, and they come to characterize this 1970s heavy metal music sound. But then there are some bands for whom the 60s are still where they're at, essentially.
Neil Young, Crosby, Stills, Nash, you know, those are band and those are definitely artists. I would say that in 1970, for them, it is still 1966. And for Chelsea, I might add that 1970 still seems a bit like 1966, but we'll get into that more
Well, we'll
later.
get into, yeah, exactly. We'll get a lot into that as we do the track by track.
It's actually a very interesting record, and I will leave that alone. And I'm sure we're going to hear some classic phrases out of the two of us for this one. But
Absolutely, we are. You've already done the Mighty Boosh reference, so you know what I'm going to say quite a lot.
yes, I do. I am well
Yeah.
aware. I heard it in my head while I was listening to the album earlier
Yeah.
today. But I mean, there's not really a whole lot of information on this band. This probably is the last gasp of Peter Criss before he joins Kiss, because he doesn't join Kiss for another 3 years. And
Yeah.
3 years as I mean, if you want to talk about Peter Criss as a human being in 1971, 1972, I think it's kind of important. This comes directly from his autobiography. This is not me trying to say mean things about Peter Criss. You're going to get a lot of information about Peter from me that may or may not seem flattering today. And this information comes not just from Gene Simmons' autobiography, not just from the Ace Frehley autobiography, and not just from the Paul Stanley autobiography, but from the Peter Criss autobiography. He has confirmed all the horrible things that were said about him. He apologized and he said, "Hey, I was young, I was emotional, and you know, I did a lot of things I shouldn't have done." So when I say something that it sounds really angry or upset with Peter, this is why, because he said it too. So in, Chelsea, I don't even know if they even had a tour because they were only active for about a year. They got together in 1970 and they broke up in 1971. And during that time, during that, we'll call it 15 months just to be nice, during that 15-month period, they recorded two albums. And I'm gonna guess that second album didn't get recorded in 6 days, and probably the first album didn't get recorded in 6 days. When you hear a lot about bands recording their first album very quickly, it's because they had been playing those songs for so long. And I don't know how much they were in the studio. I don't know anything. But so Peter Criss, when this ends, he is essentially a man-child. He has no idea how to pay bills. His wife is supporting him. His wife, Lydia, is putting all the money on the table. And when he is found by Kiss, he is working as a drummer in a jazz trio in a small Italian restaurant. That's a pretty big fall from somebody on a major label record deal that goes nowhere. I mean, that's probably a big part of why he was so angry in those early years, is because he felt like he had it. And I don't know which band's music he preferred, whether it was Chelsea or whether it was Kiss, but I would imagine that he much preferred being in Chelsea and not having to wear makeup and not having to do silly gimmicks and things and not nearly dying every night when a drunk roadie screws up on the levitating drum set. But that's just me talking. That's just Nick. What do I know?
Who knows? Who knows? All right. Well, so the only other notable thing that I can think of here is that John Cale played viola on two tracks on this record, which we'll get into which ones later on. But I'm not quite sure how that collaboration happened, whether that was maybe facilitated by the label or if they just somehow knew John Cale
Well, he
or
worked
whatever.
with Velvet Underground.
Well, yeah, absolutely. He was a member of Velvet Underground.
Oh, I did not realize he was a member. I guess if I would have read this a little bit better, he was a founding member of the American rock band, the Velvet Underground.
That's who he is. Yeah, exactly.
I would guess that there was probably somebody working in this album. And see, the producer is Louis Merenstein.
He's done lots of stuff, most notably Van Morrison.
So, being as this is recorded in New York, the Velvet Underground is a New York band. It is a New York sensation. I would wager that he probably had some sort of a connection.
Oh yeah, in fact, he's produced albums for John Cale.
Well, there
Has
you
this
go.
guy, Louis Merenstein, so he's probably the producer that sorted that out. There we
So,
are.
that's pretty cool that they had something like that there,
Yeah.
for a
Well,
band
let's.
that's completely. Just completely unknown and forgotten. I
I
did take
don't
a
know how they
look.
got signed either. Does it say how they got signed? No, it doesn't say how they got signed. It's
There
strange
is.
how these bands that just seem to come from nowhere sometimes and just get signed to these major labels.
Well,
But there you go.
back in the 70s, they believed that they could take a band and form them and make them into something. Think about Pink Floyd. Oft referenced Pink Floyd on this podcast. The Dark Side of the Moon was like their eighth album.
Something like that, yeah.
They didn't have a hit until album number eight.
This is true.
I
Yeah, they
mean,
used to give bands the time to develop, basically.
right. And Rush's biggest hit was 2112, and that was like their fifth or sixth album. And
Yeah, very true, very
after
true.
like five albums, the label said to him, "Hey, you guys gonna have to get a hit or we're done here." So make some short songs, make some poppy songs, and of course they come back with 2112, which has a 25-minute rock opera on side one. Well, clearly they understood the assignment, but it was a major hit, so Rush knew better. And so the idea, so I mean, it's kind of actually embarrassing that Chelsea only got just a little bit. They didn't get much rope on this. And I would say in 1970, there's probably enough quality here. If they could have gotten over a little bit, that this could have been something. This is not an embarrassingly bad record. This is definitely not a record worthy of being dropped from your label after one album.
Yeah, well.
We've done, I will say this, I will tip my hand a little bit. We have done way worse music on this podcast than
Oh,
this
we
right here.
definitely have. Some of it
We,
involving Peter Chris.
I was going to say the same thing. Some of it
Yes.
involving Peter Criss. It was Let Me Rock You was way worse than this. Did we do All for One?
Can't remember.
Wow. I've only heard, I can only remember off the top of my head a couple of songs from it, and that, oh my Lord. You know what? I don't think I hate you that much. I don't think I hate you that much to make you listen to that album. But yes, we have done far worse music on this album, on this podcast, by large, and you know, some of it involving Peter Criss. So the fact that they got dropped so quickly, I mean, that's just really weird. In 1973, a couple of the guys from the band, Pete Shepley and Mike Brand, recorded an unreleased album, which included a post-Chelsea Michael Benvenga and pre-Kiss Peter Criss and two songs with Gene Simmons on two songs Gene Sim with Gene Simmons as session musicians titled Captain Sanity.
There you
So
go. That'll be an interesting one to hear.
there are two unreleased albums involving this group. I mean, that is nuts. God, I wonder how
Is that
terrible
right?
that
Is that
thing
the
is.
second unreleased one? I see.
Yeah, because it's two of them. The singer and the guitar player ended up doing an album with with two of the other guys from this band and Gene Simmons.
There you go.
And it was not it was also not released. Wow. I can't imagine what that would feel like to have a second album go completely unreleased by your label.
Exactly. Yeah.
Unless this was something that they just recorded in the hopes of getting, oh, in the hopes of selling it. But either way, that would still feel pretty awful to me to try to sell these things and lose out.
Yeah. All right. Shall we get into the track by track?
I suppose we are just kind of rolling along, waiting to get for it.
All right. Rolling along, track one. So this is. Straight away, this is screaming 1960s at me rather than 1970s. It's very Beatlesy. You've got this bluesy R&B shuffle groove going on. It's very poppy. You've got these catchy hooks. It's catchy. It's good. It's like decent 60s pop, but then it starts to border into really silly territory with these do 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 bits, which I'm not doing a great impression of, but they have these do 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 bits, which are kind of laughable. It changes to straight time and gets a little bit more Rolling Stonesy, but still very much rooted in the 1960s. The vocals are quite decent, bluesy snarl. There's lots of lead guitar, most of it amongst the vocals. We don't have many solos on this album. There are no solos as such on this track, guitar solos, but there's loads of lead guitar just kind of whittling over the in between the vocals, basically. And that's it. It's got a nice, strong chorus hook. It's quite good for what it is, but the do-do-do bits are a little bit laughable, and it's so 60s, and we're in 1970 now.
Yeah, but I mean, this is recorded in early 1970. I love the dates that are available for this. Recorded early 1970, released late 1970. All right. Thank you for your very specific and very helpful. I should also mention this actually was released on CD.
Wow.
Let me verify that that's not a counterfeit. No, it was released on CD.
Proper
Oh.
CD. Nice.
This was released on CD in 2011, however, 2011. So it looks like somebody bought the released by Mandala, a label specializing in reissues of Canadian and American and Canadian prog, psych, blues, rock albums from the 70s. Okay. So it looks like somebody tried to get a couple of bucks off this, and I'm gonna guess they did not. But yeah, the first song of this album, it's very much steeped in like 1968, if I'm being kind. It's
If you're
not.
being kind, I'd say it's more 1966 or 7 myself, but yeah.
Well, if I'm being honest, I would say more like 1965.
Yeah,
There's,
yeah.
you know, there's a lot of folk rock influence on this song, and probably the most folk rocky of the entire album, but I don't think that is something if you want to lead off with if you're not doing a folk rock record. That's kind of something you tuck back in later. Is it a bad song? No. Is it exactly what I expected? Kind of. Is that a good thing? Well, that's really up to you to decide. I can't choose that for you. But it wasn't so bad that at the end of the song, I said, you know what? Let's call it a day.
Track two, let's call it a day. So, this one reminded me more of Procol Harum. We're definitely into psychedelia territory here. So, there you go. That's my catchphrase, it's psychedelic. So, here we are with exactly that. It's a slow 6/8 time signature. You've got these sweet strings adding to the moody blues or Procol Harum-esque sound. You've got quite a lot of time signature changes. The vocals are quite lost in the mix, and that just made me reflect on the fact that this album is quite rough sonically. So the production and the mix are not great. Again, sounds like a mid-60s production, a bit rough. When we think about, we've got the Led Zeppelin are on their third album by now, by 1970, and
Yeah, Led Zeppelin 3 is a 1970 album.
exactly. And the sonics there are just so much more squeaky clean than what we're hearing here. So this is not bad, 60s style psychedelia, but it's out of date for the time, and this is the problem here, and this is going to be a running theme for this album. And the thing is, if they do, we can put that to one side and we can judge this on its own terms, and we can say, all right, well, just imagine it's 1966. Would this be brilliant for 1966? I don't know. I think it's all been done before and probably better in the 60s. So this is the problem. But yeah, look, there's some quite impassioned bits. There's some great drumming. I have to say, throughout, there is a lot of great drumming. So Peter Criss's potential and his ability is very much palpable throughout. But is this a great song? No, I don't think it is. Is it quite a good song? Yeah, sure. Is it out of date for 1970? Yes.
This is the song where I heard some Cream influence. And I think a lot of us, when we think of Cream, for me, I always think of it as it's a musician's band. Like Steve Vai is only going to be popular with lead guitar players. Cream is only really popular with your music, with my generation, our musical heroes. Cream doesn't get involved, doesn't get into the musical canon in America. They came, they went, they lasted two years and dropped four amazing albums full of amazing songs, did everything they could do together and went their separate ways. And so many bands later on in life, later on in the history have really tried to get that sound like that sunshine of your love sound that. And they don't, nobody else really knows how to do it, but they try so hard. And that's where you get this weird psychedelic kind of sound that doesn't quite work, in my opinion. But is it a bad song? No. Is it as good as any psychedelic rock music that you probably can think of from 1968? Certainly not. Jimi Hendrix is far better than this. Cream's Goodbye was far better than this. And it's a good song. There's nothing new under the sun here. And production-wise, yeah, it's a little flat. When you brought up Led Zeppelin, and of course, Led Zeppelin, everything is produced by Jimmy Page. And Jimmy Page had been working in the studios for 10 years before he became Led Zeppelin. So he knew how to record. He watched what everybody did, and he created all of these amazing engineering tricks and all these production tricks. And but I'm gonna ignore that when I say Black Sabbath's first two records, because I believe we're on the second Black Sabbath record at this point. I believe Paranoid comes out in 1970. I believe it's Black Sabbath and Paranoid in 1970. Both of those records sound better than this one.
Yeah, they do.
I don't know how this was recorded. I don't know where it was recorded. What I do know, oh, you're right. The album was released on MCA Records, and then it says labels Decca. So there must have been. Anyway, I don't know where or how this was recorded because there's no information. It doesn't say it. All we know is the name of the producer. And was it recorded at the record plant? Was it recorded at Electric Lady Studios? Who knows? This is done in New York, so it could have been either of those places. What I do know is it doesn't sound as good as Black Sabbath's first record.
Absolutely.
And they recorded that on two four tracks in 12 hours in one day.
Indeed,
for I
yes.
think like $400.
Yeah.
And it's got much better production, much better engineering than this record does.
Yeah.
But I could harp on that some more, but like every cloud has a silver lining. Let's find it.
Track three, Silver Lining. So this starts with a fastish, upbeat 60s pop sound. And this for me is very much harking back to the 60s side of The Who, the 60s era of The Who. Very hook laden, catchy psychedelia. Still rough sounding production wise, but quite anthemic. And some interesting rhythm jumps at the end, led by Peter Criss. So I liked this track more. I thought this one worked better. I thought it was catchy. It was like good 60s psychedelic pop. Still 60s, though, not 70s.
Yeah, but if we're going to be really, really honest, can't we say that Black Sabbath was still a little bit 60s in the 70s?
I don't know. I think they'd moved things on. I think they pushed things forward and kind of created a whole new style and a whole new way of doing things, which was there even on that first album. And don't forget, I think their first album was released in 69 in the UK.
Was it?
Think so.
I always keep hearing that. But anyway, Black Sabbath is still psychedelic and a little swirly, and I don't know. I'm just trying to find something nice to say right now. And
I mean, none of these are bad. None of these are awful tracks at all so far. It's just comparing them to the really strongest 60s psychedelia that exists. I don't think they're up there. And then you think, well, this was 1970 as well. So this was after all of that 60s psychedelic stuff, all the classic stuff. So you can't help but feel it's just not up there.
That's really fair. It's a lot like listening to when we future or previous podcast subject Joe Perry Project, I've Got the Rock and Rolls Again. When we really sat down and listened to that, there was nothing offensively bad about it, and there was nothing offensively good about it either. If
Offensively good, I like that phrase.
I don't know if that actually even makes any sense, but
Probably not.
But for some reason, I just kind of wanted to go with it. So you know what? That's going to be the new, the Department of Metal Antiquities. It's offensively good.
Offensively good. Yep.
But no, it's not bad. This is also probably the best song on the record so far, and it is one of the two songs on the entire album that is not written by the team of Mike Brand and Peter Shepley. This is written by Ben Venga, the bass player, and Chris Arides, who is one of the guitar players. This is just a weird album so far. And that first song, Rolling Along, really sticks out right now. Because it's like they wrote that one and went, that's a song. We wrote it. Let's completely write other things.
Yeah.
So I'm confused. But next we move on into the unpunnable All-American Boy.
All American Boys. So this has a slow 6/8 groove to it. This is where they start to go a bit Americana. So I didn't notice so much of the folk rock in that Rolling Along track, maybe a little bit, but here is where I started to notice that more. So you've got this psychedelia, this Americana psychedelic thing. You've got some minor key over major key stuff, which I quite like that mix. There's some good tension there. It's a bit different. You've got these big choir vocals over the chorus. It's like a big anthemic country track gone pop rock. And you know what? I think this track is pretty good for what it is. Again, you've got lots of lead guitar going on around the vocals. No solos, but loads of lead guitar dipping in and out. So the production and the mix are not great, but this one works quite well for me. I do like my country music, my Americana, and this sort of borrows from that lexicon, but then puts it into a frame of still 60s, but pop rock. And I kind of liked it.
Yeah, we're moving back into that kind of Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young kind of vibe
Yeah.
where a lot of big open chords, a lot of little minor lead and melody breaks. And I didn't grow up during that era. I didn't I mean I'm old, but I'm not dying as much as if I were alive at that time. But that music, that kind of music is just so dated to me. It's like hearing a disco song, because disco only existed for 5 years. It's like hearing an English punk rock song. It's like hearing, the Ramones, and it just, when I hear, or grunge even, or pop punk, when I hear those genres of music, it takes me right back to a very specific time. So there's just no way that All American Boy in 1970, because when we've bandied about Led Zeppelin, right? As we should, because it's Led Zeppelin. Led Zeppelin's on their third record, and the very creatively titled Three. And Black Sabbath is on their second record, and Deep Purple is on, about to release Machine Head, and Iron Butterfly is coming, basically come and gone. And you have a complete shift. I mean, even the Doors, who were psychedelic, weren't folky. Even though Robbie Krieger played a lot of open chords, it wasn't folky. The Doors were even more contemporary than that. And the Doors are about to release their fifth album,
LA Woman, isn't it? Oh, Morris
Morrison.
Hotel.
LA
Fair enough.
Woman was 1971.
Was it? Okay. I'm going to check
71?
that. I'm going to
Yeah,
check that.
71.
Yeah.
And Morrison Hotel is Morrison Hotel is the American response to the British response to American blues. And the Red Rover, can I come over game of back and forth between England and America with the blues is like one of my favorite musical games of telephone ever. So All American Boy, just comparing it to the Doors, who started off psychedelic and moved away from it, sounds dated.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to really get into those kinds of songs, because it genres of music that are movements are a lot less interesting to me than genres of music that are revolutions. As Tommy Lee Jones explained in the movie Under Fire, the Steven Seagal movie, Under Siege, excuse me, the Steven Seagal movie Under Siege, which I do not recommend anyone watch it under any circumstances whatsoever. He said, this is not a movement. A movement goes so far and then it stops. A revolution is called that because it keeps spinning. Okay, I agree. So, thrash metal, heavy metal, power metal, these things are revolutions. Americana, folk rock, these things are movements. And at this time, when this folk rock song is coming out, the movement had already ended. And it had ended a while back. So here we are, still getting old music. And I think we can all agree, since this is the Department of Metal Antiquities, we are at least looking for some hard rock music.
Which is track five. So this starts with fast, frantic acoustic guitar strumming. So not really hard rock music at all, but okay.
Not even a little.
No, and then it kicks in with harmony vocals singing the title as a hook, and it's pretty good. But the thing is, this is not hard rock. This is more like the Rolling Stones meets Jefferson Airplane. It's very hippie-ish and it's past its time. This was really 1967 music. We've moved on since then. It continues in that vein with some interesting bass and some good percussion. There's some lead guitar, including a couple of bluesy solos. But the problem here is it doesn't really do anything to vary. It just stays on pretty much one chord. Keeps on repeating the hook with these very, very minimal verses that you almost can't call them verses, and hardly any dynamic change. It's also one of the longest tracks on the album at 5 minutes 10, and I don't think it needs to be as long as that by any stretch. So there's some great drumming and percussion, and there is finally a bit of a breakdown towards the end before it builds back up and then finishes, but it's just too little too late. So this is a strangely arranged track, and it's just so odd that he's screaming about hard rock music over something that is nothing really to do with hard rock music.
Now, in fairness, I wasn't alive in 1970, and I certainly wasn't conscious to music until, 1982 or 1983. But I believe the term hard rock music was an accurate, descriptor back then. And what they would have called hard rock in 1970, we would still call hard rock in 2024. And hard rock music never involves quickly strumming acoustic guitars. Staccato acoustics does never qualify as hard rock. What the hell is this song? This is the first song that I'm going to say is bad. And maybe it's only bad because of the lyrics. When they're singing hard rock music, and I feel like, are you around a campfire right
Yeah.
now? When you say this is 1967 music, I'm going to disagree strongly. In 1967, this music would have been dated.
Yeah, maybe.
This is like, I mean, this sounds to me like early Beach Boys or early Beatles, like way old. This might even be like 10 years old at this point. I mean, it's just so wrong. And I mean, like the first track on this side and the last track on this side stick out like sore thumbs. It just doesn't make sense on this album.
Yeah.
Well, let's go ahead and flip the record and hope they go crazy without jumping in the river like Ophelia.
Ophelia, yeah, Shakespeare reference there. So,
I'm very literate. I'm very literary.
there
I
you.
don't know if that comes across, so I'm just gonna throw it out there.
I once did it in school. I once did a reenactment of Ophelia jumping in the river, and I was playing Ophelia. So anyway, there we go. But let's move swiftly on. So this starts with some steady syncopated acoustic, very whimsical psychedelia. And it kicks in a bit heavier with some late 60s rock and roll vibes with some poppy hand clips, but it's hand clips, hand claps. But there's a bit of beef going
Hand
on. And
clips, that's my new band name.
there you go, hand clips. But there's a bit of beef to it. And I like that bit of beef that they're adding into this late 60s rock and roll sound. And straight away, I'm thinking the Kinks. Not quite as heavy as some of the Kinks' is really riffy stuff, but that the sort of mid-range of hard rockness that the Kinks might have done on some of their tracks. So this is pretty good, and it's got a nice catchy chorus hook as well. It gets a bit more like the Faces a bit later on with a steady rock and roll, kind of these feel-good earthy guitars, which I like, I have to say. It is still structurally a little bit odd, like the previous track, Hard Rock Music, where there's not really much of a verse. There's just a lot of chorus and not a whole lot else. But I kind of like this track, so it was picking up a bit for me.
This album is just so damn weird. This band doesn't know who they are. They have no idea what they're trying to do. And okay. You know what? It sounds like this is a recording of every song they've ever written, going back to when they were 10. And Ophelia, it's something. It is definitely something. It is definitely a song. It is definitely on the record. Moving on down, they are winding, they are crazy, it is a long river.
Long River. So this is one of the two tracks which features John Cale on viola. And there's an out of tune, a noticeably out of tune 12-string guitar doing some steady to fast rock and roll style strumming. Then it kicks in a bit heavier with an electric guitar lead riff thing and some driving drums. And it's getting into the Faces sort of style again with some nice bluesy snarling Rolling Stones Mick Jagger vocals. I'm quite liking it at this point. You've got some good building tension stuff with the drums as it ebbs and flows dynamically, which works pretty well for me. And then you've got a bluesy guitar solo with some psychedelic effects underneath, and it all builds quite nicely, this track, and then ends abruptly. So I quite like the psychedelic wig out nature of this, the weirdness of it, the way that it ebbed and flowed with the dynamics. So yeah, this one was on form.
This album is quickly reminding me, now that we've gotten into the very psychedelic part of it, it reminds me a lot of Piper at the Gates of Dawn by Pink Floyd, where they are playing rock music. Sometimes it's even a little hard rock. It's still a little folky. It's still very poppy. And it's a little bit crazy. And I don't know if they were trying to sound like they were coming out of the village or what they're doing here, but it's a weird record. And I mean, I know I've said that more than once, but I'm probably going to say it a few more times as well. The psychedelic pop is so odd for 1970. When Kiss in 1974 starts releasing late 60s, early 70s folk rock songs. And I know a lot of people are going to be saying, "What?" But they played those songs. They adapted those songs to 1974. They played them through Marshall Stacks with a crap ton of distortion through them. So it sounded contemporary, even though it really wasn't. You know, when they were doing songs like Lover All I Can and Anything for My Baby and Sunday Driver, or Let Me, I guess the song is actually Let Me Know. I don't remember the name of that song. It's either Sunday Driver or Let Me Know. I forget which is the beat, the first and which is the last. But they adapted their sound to mesh with, you know, the modern day. And this just sounds like it's the exact same stuff they would have played if it were 1965. And it's so weird. I'm trying to get through this. I'm trying to find just a little bit of grace.
All right, Grace is track 8. So this is where it completely changes gear and it goes into a slow,
Did
jazzy.
you leave out the word again?
Yeah, possibly, but it really, this is a curveball and a half, this one. So it goes into this slow, jazzy, bluesy thing with some hemiola and some syncopation. So the beats and the rhythms are jumping around quite a lot. This is one where the only track where they're joined by someone called Steve Loeb on piano, and there's quite a lot of prominent piano on this track. Lots of changes, some interesting psychedelic chord sequences, lots of lead guitar doing jazzy, bluesy stuff. But for me, this one just feels too rambling and directionless, and it just doesn't do a whole lot. It just whimsically goes off on its jazzy, bluesy path for however many minutes it lasts for, and then just goes away again, and it doesn't leave any lasting impact. So, no, I'm not a big fan of this track.
Have we hit the Chelsea Jazz Odyssey?
We have indeed the Chelsea Jazz Odyssey.
Derek Smalls, he wrote this.
Exactly.
How can it be a rambling nut bar song if it only goes on for 3 minutes?
Feels longer.
3 minutes feeling longer is not a good thing, kids. That is precisely what you don't want to do. It's a lot like when I tried to listen to those Roger Waters Dark Side of the Moon Redux tracks. I don't know if you listen to any of those, Duncan.
Well, yeah, I did one or two. I did not like them.
Did you finish one?
No.
I did not either. I remember listening to Time, which was like the first one, and I'm like, wow, this is really great.
Then he
And
starts singing.
then what appears to be like 17 minutes later, I'll wait to get the record to hear the rest of this. And I looked down and it was 2 minutes. I don't even know
Yeah.
if I got to the singing. I'm like, wow, this is, and that's just kind of how Grace is, you know? I mean, it's only 3 minutes, but it feels like 12. And you know what? That's going to save you on recording costs, though. If you can make your song seem like they're so much longer, you don't have to spend the time recording it. But that is not a good thing. Let us go ahead and move on into the unpunnable Polly Vaughn, which is the only song which features a Peter Criss songwriting credit. It's actually all four of them, as it were, but Peter Criss is there too.
Okay. So this begins with some steady acoustic guitar strumming, and then timpanis and orchestral instruments come in, and it's very moody blues style. And it kicks in with a full psychedelic full band into the verse. The chorus is quite good and quite dramatic, not helped by the muddy production, but for what it is, it's pretty good. The actual arrangement and the song itself and the melodies are decent. Lots of lead guitar again and a solo, which is a bit buried in the mix. And you know what? This is quite good, but again, I'm just going to repeat the same point. It's so 60s, and that is the big issue with this whole record. And it's all been done way better at least 5 years earlier. You know, there were bands and records out in 1965 who were doing this sort of stuff better than it's been done here. So what's the point, to be blunt?
I mean, I think you've kind of summed up so far most of this record right now is what is the point? If you don't have anything to say, you don't have anything to sell. And, you know, am I going to buy a soda when I'm already drinking a soda?
You are not.
If I've got a cold Mountain Dew in my hand that I just took one sip and I'm at the store and they say, buy a Mountain Dew. Well, if it's the same Mountain Dew, I mean, I'm not going to buy a second Mountain Dew unless I really want to. And that's, yeah, I mean, that's exactly the problem here, is it's we are not moving the needle forward in any possible way. If you don't listen to a lot of this music, then you probably don't feel that way. But if you don't listen to a lot of this music, why would you be listening to it now? I guess that's the better question. Anyway, whatever this song is, it will leave you with good company.
Okay, well, this is the shortest track. It's 1 minute 44. Features John Cale on a very prominent viola again. So this has some fast-ish Americana style strumming and some lead, both on acoustic guitars and the viola. And it's very much a down-homey Americana country song. It's catchy, it's pretty good, and there's some nice vocal harmonies, and it just comes and it goes and ends quickly. And it's probably one of the best tracks on the album, actually. Maybe it's the best track on the album.
It's unfortunate when your best track is the last one. Just going to say that. It's also really unfortunate when the best track on your record is the shortest one.
Yes.
Are we talking about Good Company still?
Yes.
Okay, cool. I'm sorry, my brain went fuzzy for a second. This song has got that big sing-along. Good Company, looking for good. I mean, it sounds like a traveling. It's like a song that was in a Muppets movie. I could easily see this song being played while they're driving down the road in a Muppets movie. Is that a good thing or a bad thing if you're trying to be a serious rock band? That's
I
probably.
don't know. I mean, I liked the track, but now when you present it like that doesn't feel like a good thing.
Does it, after you've heard the track, does it sound like I'm wrong?
Maybe not. No.
No, it sounds, I mean, to me, it completely sounds like a song that Kermit the Frog and the Fozzie Bear would be singing when they were going down the road, looking for good company.
I mean, yeah, I can see that. I can see that.
I guess I really don't have anything else to say about that song because I don't know how I follow that up. I'll let you move into your sum up.
Okay, well, for my sum up, what do I think about this album? Look, I just think there's two problems with it. Number one, they're still stuck in the 60s, production-wise, songwriting-wise, style-wise. But number two, even if we take this for what it is and we just pretend that it is 1965 or 1966, there's so much better stuff out there that does all of this but better. So I think it has to be a bin it from me, unfortunately, in spite of the plenty of great musicianship, plenty of great drumming, plenty of pretty good hooks, actually. It's a high bin it, but it's nevertheless a bin it from me. There we are.
Well, I mean, the thing about this for me is I'm not big on psychedelic music. I'm really not big on proper prog, but I don't know if that really qualifies as proper prog. I'm always going to be a little bit biased when we get into, Kiss family and Kiss related music because that is basically my favorite band. And that is the band where I really started delving into the side projects, the earlier projects, and all that kind of stuff. And I have accidentally indoctrinated my child into doing the exact same thing. So she has recently gotten into the Strokes, a band of whom I am not that enamored with, but she is now talking about The Voids, which is the lead singer side project and the drummer's solo records. And I mean, I'm like, wow, that's so awesome that you care about this. So when it comes to that stuff, I'm always going to be a bit, shall we say, sympathetic to the artists involved. And this album is not terrible. This album is not great. It kind of straddles the line between clever and stupid, because it's a very fine line between clever and stupid. And sometimes it's stupid and sometimes it's clever. So they're not always straddling the line, but they're always within, two deviations from the norm from it. And that's the problem, is it's they were always within two standard deviations of the norm if this were 6 or 7 years before it was released. How they released this album like this, it's like where were you guys? I mean, these guys aren't 40, so it's not like they grew up on this kind of music, but then it's also kind of like a cavalcade of all of the styles of the 1960s. They play that Beach Boys rock, they play that Beatles rock, they play that Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young Americana. They play a little bit of the Byrds. They even get into a little bit of Doors and Cream, and then they finish it up with the Partridge Family. which that was, I mean, they were actually earlier than that, you know, because hard rock music and Good Company, you know, those could be the Muppets, those could be the Partridge Family. And it never feels like they have a position. They've never staked out a musical claim in this world. They're just kind of writing, which makes Peter Criss the perfect choice to join Kiss. Because Kiss is the same way. They never chose a style of music, no matter what is your favorite era of Kiss and my favorite era of Kiss. If they're different, it's largely they're playing different kinds of music. And if you look at 1974, they're playing Americana music, they're playing hippie rock over amplified and slightly meaner and tuned down, which makes it not sound like Good Company or hard rock music. If Kiss gets a hold of hard rock music, you know, it probably is a hard rock song at the time. It's just, I mean, is this album good? No. Would I listen to it again if I came across it on vinyl at a reasonable price? However, the likelihood of that happening is very, very small. On Discogs, this thing basically starts at $100.
Wow.
And you know what I'm not going to do ever?
Pay $100 for this record.
No, I will never pay $100 for this record. It is not, I don't want to hear it that bad. And I guess, in my heart of hearts and in my honest opinion, even though I enjoyed listening to this album and I enjoyed discovering it and exploring it, I don't want to listen to it again. So, unfortunately, I'm a Bennett as well.
There we are.
I expected that, but I hoped. I had hope that this was
Dare
going to
to
surprise
dream,
me.
Nick. Dare to dream.
I always dare to dream. Anything else this week, Duncan?
No, I don't think so, but thank you to everybody for listening.
Everyone, thank you very much for listening. If you've made it this far, if you could subscribe, interact with us on Twitter, D Evans Music, or NIK underscore NO underscore C, Nick No C, or Glacially Musical on Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, and Threads. If you could leave a review or just tell one friend, you know, if you have one friend that enjoys listening to classic rock and classic metal, you know, I feel like this is the podcast for them. And that being said, thank you very much for listening. Duncan, thank you very much for joining me as always. This has been the Department of Metal Antiquities. We listened so you didn't have to.